Is it time for a podcast already?
Check 1-2, check 1-2, check 1-2, check 1-2.
I didn't know that.
What's up, listeners? Welcome back to another episode of the Garlic Jar Podcast Show. We are coming at you tonight on a nice warm summer evening here. Tonight, we're broadcasting a little bit earlier than we typically do, so the sun is slowly setting, and with me tonight, I have, of course, Matt.
Hello.
And we have brought back one of ours and your favorite guests, Sean Kane. You there, Sean?
Yes. Yeah, there thanks we go. For that introduction, Jen.
Yeah. So
great to be here with you guys.
Sean is the heavy hitter guest of pretty much the whole year. Whenever he comes on and does episodes with us, you guys just absolutely, you know, like, share, repeat, and he is the heavy hitter champion.
When it comes to ratings, yeah, like downloads and plays, yeah. That's absolutely that's a true statement in itself.
Yeah, so, the belt. Yep. The title belt belongs to Sean.
I was even thinking about that, Jen. Like, I was thinking, like, a couple days ago where it's like, you know, we got to send him, like, one of those WWE belts.
Oh,
you
yeah.
Know?
Yeah.
And somehow get the Garlic Jar logo on there.
Yeah.
And, yeah. You know?
Well, I'm an old wrestling fan, so yeah.
No, you never know. One might be coming your way.
Thank you, guys.
Yeah. So
no, but it's going
to
be a fun episode tonight.
Yeah,
this is going to be a good one.
You cooked up a good story for us tonight, and I'm very interested to hear, because, to be quite honest with you, all right, so for the listeners, we are doing an episode tonight about Mob Activity. So for me, like, of course I've seen, you know, like, The Sopranos and, you know, like, the TV shows, but, like, the real true crime mobs, it's kind of like a new topic for me. So, like, you know, like, I'm more of, like, the TV movie series kind of familiarity with the mob there. The fake stuff, well, if you will.
You know, I think Hollywood does such an injustice, though, with the mob stuff, because they really do kind of glamorize mm-hmm. it, you know?
Yeah.
And these guys are as brutal as it gets. I mean, there's no other way. And you'll see tonight. I mean, I'm not going to hold any punches. We're going to tell some stories, so if there's some people that, you know, have a weak stomach, they might as well not listen tonight.
Oh, man. Okay. That's getting me excited already. And you know what? I can't wait, because we're having, like, penne vodka, like, for dinner. So, like, that's going to be my after treat after this. So, oh, my God.
Yeah. So then, before we get into the episode, though, we're going to throw some pop culture at you, Sean. Did you watch the trailer for The Many Saints of Newark?
Oh, I did.
Yeah.
I did. Many times.
So
many times.
What are your thoughts? You think it's going to be a good film coming up?
I do. I was a big fan of the series Sopranos. I think it was really good. I think it was actually pretty realistic when you look at the whole, you know, entirety of the series. I think it was pretty well done. But I'm really interested in the movie, because it seems like, you know, with the young Tony, there's going to be a dynamic there with his uncles and stuff. So that's going to be interesting. It's really going to be, I think it's going to really
be
good.
Yeah, I'm excited for that one.
I think it's, me too. And, like, I guess I didn't realize until, like, after I saw the trailer, but the kid playing Tony is actually James Gandolfini's
son,
Michael.
Yes.
Yeah, which I think is amazing.
Yes.
How about that, huh?
It really is. It really is.
So I'm definitely looking forward to that. I think that one comes out a little bit later in the fall.
Yeah, I think it was like October, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Something like that?
Yeah, I think
October
so.
20, yep.
And it'll be in theaters and on HBO Max.
Yep.
Yeah, October 1st.
Yeah, that's definitely going to be a good one. It's definitely going to be a good one.
So
you know what? Yes. I was thinking about this, and before we get into Sean's talks here tonight, because I know he's probably got so many cooked up topics ready to roll, I was thinking of an episode, because, you know, it's actually kind of funny that you mentioned that, Sean, about, like, how Hollywood could really put a spin on things. They could really make the theatrics speak.
Yeah.
And you know it, and you know it's like a typical Hollywood element rather than be the real life element or the real explanative behind what could be a mob activity. So tonight, I mean, we go into a special episode here of episode 56. I had it titled, and I mean, this is just up for grabs because I like to share the titles anymore. Making of the Mob.
That's a good one.
Okay.
Are we good with that?
Yeah, we're right, good.
So this is season 2, episode 56, Making of the Mob.
The only thing is I'm going to try to get as much as I can in tonight, but I don't think I think we're going to have to do like a series on this.
We could do a part two plus, for sure.
I mean, I think tonight we're probably like I'm going to go through a bunch of background and stuff, and then I want to go by cities, and you know, tonight I want to hit the big three, New York, Boston, okay. Chicago. And after that, I don't know, you know, if we're going to have any time to get anything else. But there's so much more that I want to get into.
Comfortably, why don't we do this as a part one tonight?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Are we?
Part one.
All right, part one it is.
Part one.
Take
so,
control of the wheel and navigate.
Ready, sir. Yep.
And I did get a bunch of questions and stuff, but we just not gonna have time. Let's get right into the mob stuff.
Yeah, we can address the questions and probably more questions because you guys love to hit Sean with the questions there. So yeah, we'll make, you know, a collective of the questions and then we will address them at a later time.
Sounds good.
All right, we're ready.
Okay,
to go,
we
sir.
Ready?
Yep.
Okay, so. You know, when I'm doing this episode tonight, I'm going to strictly be talking about American Cosa Nostra, which is, you know, the Italian-American mafia, and the dynamic between the Italian gangster, the Irish gangster, and the Jewish gangster. And that basically is what would make up the American syndicate. And that's basically what controlled organized crime for, you know, 100-plus years. So, obviously, there's other, you know, powerful... ethnic, you know, crime families, especially outside of the United States. You have, you know, the Japanese Yakuza and the Chinese triads and certainly the cartels like the Pablo Escobar. And that's a different thing. Even the Italian mafia, you know, in Italy, there's three factions. There's the Sicilian mafia, which is the oldest family. There's the Ndrangheta, which is probably the most powerful right now. They're like a army unto itself. And then the Camorra. So that's a different level. Like tonight, we're just strictly talking American mob.
Yeah.
You know. So basically, I got three sources when I the three best sources for most of my information is number one is T.J. English. I don't know if you guys ever heard of T.J. English. Did you see any books by him or read any books by him or see any Did you ever seen any documentaries on the mob? Because you've probably seen T.J. English.
I was just gonna say this is ringing a bell in the documentary department.
Well, he wrote a book on the Westies, which is the Irish mob in Hell's Kitchen. Yep. He wrote a book called Paddywhack, which is like the study of the Irish-American underworld. He sat down. He did interviews. He wrote a book on Whitey Bulger called Where the Bodies Are Buried. And he interviewed a lot of Whitey's guys and sat down with them. And he interviewed Sammy the Bull Gravano, who was John Gotti's underboss, the Gambino family. So this is a guy who's just such a good writer. He was a taxi cab driver actually in the 70s in Hell's Kitchen. So he has some great stories that he could add into that, like what was going on in that time period. But he's just such a good writer, and he's such a good researcher too. So he really, a lot of the information I get is from him. And then the other two sources, actually, believe it or not, are from actual gangsters. And they're, you know, it tells you how the mob has changed because you could go on YouTube and see interviews with him now. But one is John A. Light and the other is Michael Franchese. I don't know if you guys ever seen anything with those guys.
I don't think so.
Yeah, they're actual gangsters who, you know, they got out of the life and they go around and they actually talk to kids and try to talk them out of the streets, you know, and not getting into that life because they say, the only way it's going to end is you're either going to end up getting killed or you're going to end up in jail. And that's true. I mean, there's no, especially today, you know, with the way law enforcement is and cameras everywhere. I mean, it's just, you know, there's no end to it other than that, you know. So, but those two guys, like, they really, like, if you listen to them and you listen to their stories. And I know there's trolls on the internet, you know, sitting in their grandmother's basement, you know, on the computer, and they're saying they're liars and stuff. But these guys are real gangsters. I mean, John A. Light, he worked for John Gotti Sr., you know, and he was half Albanian on his dad's side, so he couldn't be a maid guy, because you have to be, to be a maid guy in Cosa Nostra, you have to be 100% Italian. And then at some point in the late 70s, early 80s, they changed it to you had to be just 100% Italian on your father's side.
Okay.
So he couldn't be made. But he was really close to John Sr., so close that he put him with his son. When he made his son, John Jr., he put him with him. So he was really close with him. And Francese was an actual made guy. He was a capo in the Colombo family, which is one of the five families in New York that make up the commission.
Interesting.
So these guys are really, yeah, so these guys are the real deal. So anybody wants to check them out. And the interesting thing about Francese is he has a piece on YouTube where he reviews mob movies. So that's fascinating to hear from a real, you know, a real gangster who lived that life. And the interesting thing I get from these guys is, like, you talk about, you hear the respect that they have for, like, the Irish gangster and the Jewish gangster coming from, you know, two Italian gangsters. I mean, they really, you know, like I said before in the previous podcast, the respect on the street, they work together all the time. So that's what interests me about the dynamic between, you know, especially the Irish and the Italian gangster. But then, you know, at times it does go bad. And we're going to talk about when the wars go on, because that's when it really just, I mean, especially in Chicago in the Roaring Twenties. And I don't know if you guys ever heard about Cleveland, but I like to, you know, at some point, we probably won't get to it tonight, but I don't know if you guys ever saw the movie To Kill the Irishman.
Yes.
Did you ever see
that?
Yeah, of course.
Okay, well, we're going to talk about that tonight, because that's, you know, that was a pretty realistic movie.
I feel like that's probably one of the most, like, you know, true to colors.
Well,
it
was based on the book, and it was pretty realistic, you know, what happened. And that was an absolute war from, you know, an Irish gangster, Danny Green, who took on the Cleveland Cosa Nostra family. And there was, like, a bombing war for, like, all through the 70s, you know, like, car bombs going off, like, almost every day. It was just incredible, the war that was going on, you know. So hopefully if we get time, we'll get to that. But I do want to talk on, you know, I want to talk on the big three cities.
Yeah, we can start so, wherever you're comfortable.
Well, you know, a lot of people think that in America that organized crime did start with the Italians, but it actually started with the Irish. And I'm sure you guys seen the gangs in New York with Martin Scorsese.
Many times.
That
phenomenal
paper
on that. Yeah.
Yeah, it is. So they basically had the structure in place, you know. So what happened is then the Irish kind of assimilated a lot of them into, you know, unions and police and different things, firemen, lawyers, whatever. And then, you know, as the Italians start coming over, the Irish, a lot of them had gone on to other things, but the Irish gangster was still there. So the dynamic between the Italians and the Irish was still there. And what happened was it was really three guys that you could that are really the founders of the American syndicate. And that would be obviously Lucky Luciano, who was Sicilian, Oney Madden, who was Irish, and then Meyer Lansky, who was Jewish. And there's a movie coming out on Meyer Lansky. Harvey Keitel's going to play him.
Oh.
So, yeah. So that's going to be really interesting, because Lansky is a powerhouse. You know, and a lot of times, like, Hollywood does not do Lansky justice. Like, all the times he's a very smart guy, but they kind of always play him like he's this accountant. You know what I mean? Like, and he was a gangster. There's no doubt about it. He was a gangster. He was very smart, though, and he organized a lot of it. So those three guys are the three guys that really organized it. And what they did is they split it into 26 Cosa Nostra families.
Okay.
And within those families, you know, the Irish and the Jewish gangster worked with the Italians. And, you know, Luciano set up the five families in New York, which would be the Gambino family, the Genovese family, Lucchese, Colombo, and Bonanno. And they would be the five, they would make up the commission. And then they would take care of everything east of the Mississippi. And then west of the Mississippi would be the outfit in Chicago. And we're going to talk about Chicago tonight, because obviously when you talk Chicago, everybody talks about Al Capone. But there's a lot of myths about Al Capone that we're going to dispel tonight. You know, so That's basically the setup. You have the 26 families, and then, you know, most of the families, like New York controlled everything east. So, like, the Philly mob, the North Jersey mob, which the Sopranos are based on, I mean, they all have to answer to New York. Okay. You know, they have to answer to the commission in New York. So, basically what happened was Oney Madden's running. He's in New York. He's in Hell's Kitchen. And he's working with Luciano and Lansky. Now, Luciano hated Al Capone, And one of the myths about Al Capone is that he was a made guy at Cosa Nostra. That's a myth. He was never a made guy at Cosa. He was just a gangster that ran the south side of Chicago. Luciano would never let him in. So in New York, though, what was happening was a lot of what you had, they had these old-time, what they called mustache Pete's, that they didn't want to get into drugs. And Luciano and some of the younger guys, they did want to get into drugs because they knew there was a ton of money. So what happened was, and the rule in organized crime was, it was never like don't do drugs. It was just don't get caught.
Right.
You know, that was the rule. Like the bosses always, the money always funneled up to the bosses. They knew where it was coming from. They just, you know, they just said, that, you know, just don't get caught because they knew drugs was a messy business. But anyway, what happens is a shooting war breaks out with Luciano and the old mustache Pete's. And then through that, Oney Madden has some of his guys attack him. So what happened was, it was an understanding between Luciano, Madden, and Lansky that Madden would handle all the Irish guys nationwide, and Lansky would handle all the Jewish guys. So when Madden has an issue with, say, Legs Diamond, who was an infamous Irish gangster, or Mad Doc Cole, that's Madden's responsibility to take care of those guys. When they have a problem with Bugsy Siegel, who's a Jewish gangster, that's Lansky's problem to take care of. So, you know, I'm sure you guys seen the famous scene in Vegas when Siegel's sitting there and they shoot him through his
hotel window, right?
And he's sitting there. Yeah, yeah. So that was Lansky, you know. So what happens is, you know, like I said, the war breaks out and Mad Doc Cole actually comes after Madden. And Madden ends up hitting him and killing him in a phone booth. And then what happens is Madden just decides, you know what, I've had enough of this. You know, this is madness. So Oney Madden kind of retires, and he goes to Hot Springs, Arkansas. And he kind of just, he has like a kind of a retreat there for retired gangsters or gangsters on the lam and stuff. But he kind of retires, and he leaves his empire to a guy named Huey Mulligan. Now, Huey Mulligan was a guy who mentored Jimmy Burke, and we talked about Jimmy Burke before. And I just want to talk a little bit more about Jimmy Burke,
sure,
because I don't think the movie Goodfellas does justice how vicious Jimmy Burke was. You know, I think, like,
I was kind of getting the vibes there, Sean, when you talked about that, like how you just said, like, the empire kind of moved out to, like, an isolated area and things. Yeah. I was going to ask you, was that based on...
Well, the thing with the movie Goodfellas is that it's from Henry Hill's story, you know, and Ray Liotta did a tremendous. Ray Liotta is an awesome actor. I mean, he did a great job. But the thing is, when you talk to guys like I mentioned earlier, John Alight and Michael Franchese, these guys knew Henry Hill. They knew Jimmy Burke, and Henry Hill was like kind of the punk that, you know, the little guy who we all know that would start a fight, and then he'd go, you know, when 3-4 guys come over, he go gets his big buddy and come over. You know, that's Henry Hill, and Jimmy Burke was his big buddy. You know, Jimmy Burke, for whatever reason, Jimmy Burke liked the kid, and the only respect Henry Hill ever got was because of Jimmy Burke. Nobody would mess with Henry Hill, not because of who Henry Hill was, but because of who Jimmy Burke was.
Okay.
So I just think, like, the movie, it just doesn't do justice. Like, I mean, De Niro was great in that movie, no doubt about it, but you just don't, like, and then the other thing is, like, with the LaStanza heist, which I think is still the largest U.S. heist, if I'm not mistaken. What happened after that is Jimmy Burke and Polivario, which was Paul Sorvino's character in Goodfellas, they killed everybody that was involved in that heist, including Joe Pesci's character, Tommy DeSimone. And in the movie, you know, it's portrayed that Jimmy Burke was all broken up, and they show him crying, and he ordered the hit. You know, he killed Tommy DeSimone. I mean, they killed everybody that was involved in that heist, and they didn't do it because guys were spending money and stuff. They did it because they didn't want to share the money with anybody. So that shows you how ruthless these guys are, you know? So anyway, I just wanted to clear that up about Jimmy Burke. But anyway, so Only Manning retires. Huey Mulligan's running things. And then Huey Mulligan decides to retire, okay? And he leaves his empire to a guy he mentored, and that was Mickey Spillane. Now, I'm sure you heard that name. Now, Mickey Spillane was kind of a gentleman gangster, but he didn't have the relationship with the commission in New York that Huey Mulligan and Only Madden had. So what happens is, you know, there's a lot of problems with Spillane. He was kidnapping Italian gangsters, holding them for ransom, and a lot of times the mob would pay it because, you know, they had joint ventures with him. They just didn't want to do anything. But then a couple times the guys got injured. One time a guy got killed. Now May guy gets killed. You know, somebody has to answer for that. So all of a sudden you have the Gambino family, you know, in kind of a little war with Mickey Spillane. But the biggest mistake that Mickey Spillane ever made was he was protection money. He was on the streets, and they were charging protection money to different businesses and stuff. And one of the businesses was this accountant, and Mickey Spillane slapped the accountant around in front of his son, and his son happened to be Jimmy Coonan. Now, Jimmy Coonan would grow up to be the head of the Westies, and the Westies, there's no way to describe. The Westies are the most violent. Them and another gangster, Roy DeMeo, who was a soldier in the Gambino family. I mean, these two gangs were the most violent of any of the organized crime factions I ever read about. I mean, they're just, the violence is just unbelievable. So what happens is Spillane has an enemy for life with Jimmy Coonan. And Jimmy Coonan grows up, and he's working for him and some of his young guys that he forms his own gang. They're working for a Jewish gangster by the name of Ruby Stein. Now, Ruby Stein is a loan shark, and he's the biggest loan shark in New York. And, of course, you know, he pays the commission, the Italian Mafia commission, and Coonan's working for him. But all along, Coonan's main goal is to kill Mickey Spillane and take over the Irish side of the rackets in New York. So another problem Spillane has is that the Javits Convention Center is being built, and that is built right in the west side of Manhattan, which is, you know, Mickey Spillane's territory. So the five families want in on the convention center, and Mickey Spillane won't let them. So now there's all kind of issues there because they shared joint rackets before with Mickey Spillane that was outside of his territory. Now they got something big in his territory, and he didn't want to share anything. So what happens is the Genovese crime family, they put a hit out on Mickey Spillane. And the way they do it is they go to the Buffalo family, which is one of the 26 Cosa Nostra families, and they have a hitman, an Irish hitman by the name of Mad Dog O'Sullivan. Now, Mad Dog Sullivan is a lot of times he's called a Westie, but he wasn't a Westie. He was kind of just a loose cannon, like an independent hitman, but he did work a lot for Buffalo. So anyway, now Spillane has Sullivan going in, and he could fit in the Irish bars easier, you know, and he would go in, and he was taking out some of Spillane's closest associates. And in the meantime, Jimmy Coonan tries to hit Spillane. He tries to machine gun him down on the street. So now you're Mickey Spillane. You're getting hit from all sides. You got crazy Coonan in what will become the Westies. You got crazy Mad Dog Sullivan. You got the Gambino family. You got the Genovese family. I mean, Mickey Spillane actually makes a comment where he says he would have been safer in Belfast, Northern Ireland, because at least he would have known where the enemy was, who the enemy was, you know, because he was getting hit from all sides. So what happens is Jimmy Coonan starts to get a vicious reputation, and he takes out one of Mickey Spillane's guys, a guy by the name of Paddy Dugan. And what he does is he, after he kills him, and this is where we're going to start to get, if anybody you know, they have a weak stomach, turn it off. Because what he does is he kills Patty Duggan, and then he cuts his head off. And he's carrying around the head into the bars in Hell's Kitchen. And he's intimidating people. You know, he walks. Can you imagine the guy? He walks in a bar, and here he props up the guy's head on the bar.
That's nuts.
I mean, it's crazy. But that's Jimmy Coonan, and he was in the reputation now that Coonan has is unbelievable. And he gets spotted by a soldier in the Gambino family that I mentioned before, Roy DeMeo. Mm-hmm. And Roy DeMeo, I don't know if you guys ever heard anything on Roy DeMeo. Ray Liotta actually played him in a movie.
Okay.
But Roy DeMeo is the craziest. I think of all the Italian gangsters, I think DeMeo's like a serial killer. I mean, they don't even know how many people that him and his crew took out between him and the Westies. So anyway, he gets on Jimmy Coonan gets on his radar. So what DeMeo does is he sets up Mickey Spillane. And this is where the treachery of all organized crime. Now, they reach out to Huey Mulligan. Now, Huey Mulligan's retired down in Florida. He was lifelong friends with Spillane. He's, you know, a mentor to him. But it doesn't matter because Huey Mulligan realizes, you know, I don't want Coonan and DeMeo coming after me, so I'm going to set up Spillane for these guys. And what he does is he says a meeting with Spillane, who at this point moved out of Hell's Kitchen and he's in Queens. So what happens is they set this meeting. Car pulls up. They say that, you know, they ring the bell. They said, come on down. You know, we're here to do the meeting and stuff. And when Spillane comes down, the male's in the back of the car and he shoots him, kills him in the streets.
Wow.
And that's the end of Mickey Spillane. So then the next day, DeMeo and Coonan meet. And DeMeo tells him what happens, and now Coonan's like, you know, we're brothers forever, you know what I mean? Like, now he cements his relationship with Coonan. And Coonan basically takes over Hell's Kitchen. He takes over the west side of Manhattan. And this is where the cops coined the phrase the Westies. You know, they become, Coonan forms a gang. Everybody starts coming to him. And he forms an association with another young guy by the name of Mickey Featherstone, who just got out of Vietnam, and he's he's all messed up on drugs, and he's another whack job, and these guys are just they're just loose cannons. They're just killing everybody, and of course DeMeo is just as bad. So the one thing these guys do is they develop something. DeMeo and the Westies develop something they call the Houdini, which it was the disappearing act, and they perfected this where, and this is really going to get sick, but so what they would do is they would lure their victim to the Westies had a club, the 595 club, I think it was called in Manhattan, and DeMeo had the Gemini Lounge, I think it was in Brooklyn.
Okay.
And what they would do is they would lure the victim down and they'd take him through this long hallway, and then they'd lure him into a room, and there'd be two hitmen there, completely naked, so they wouldn't have to worry about getting blood on them. They'd be completely naked. Whoa. One guy would have a gun with a silencer, and an entire room would be wrapped up in plastic, so the room was in darkness. They lure him in the room, and the one guy shoots him in the head, and then they wrap him in plastic. And what they would do is they would take him.
Yow.
Oh, this is these guys were nuts. And then they would take him to the bathtub, and they would string him up, and then they would cut the guy's throat and let the blood drain out, because before they cut the body up, they would have to drain the body completely of blood. So this is how crazy these guys were. So what they would do, it would take, I forget how long it takes, like 45 hour and a half for all the blood to drain. What they would do is they would order pizza while they're waiting, or they would make a meal. So DeMeo was infamous for cooking a big pasta dinner while they're waiting for the victim's blood to drain from the body.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. So there was this story with this protected informant. I think his name was Dominic Mintaglio, I think was his name. He was a soldier in the Gambino family. And he worked, his uncle was Nino Gaggi, who was a big capo in the Gambino family. And he would pick up the VIG from Roy DeMeo and the Westies. No, Montigo was a Vietnam vet. He's seen a lot of action over there. And he wasn't a guy who scares easy, but he even said, like, the Westies and DeMeo freak him out. Like, they totally freak him out. So one day he goes, he tells a story. He goes to pick up the VIG, and DeMeo's there, and he's in this big apron he has, and he has this big chef's hat on, and he's sitting there, and he's making pasta, and Jimmy Coonan's there, the Westies, and DeMeo's serving the pasta to everybody. They're drinking wine, and they ask Montiglio to sit down, and he wants to get the hell out of there. He doesn't want no part of these guys, but he knows if he tries to rush out of there, these guys, they'll whack him right there. They're crazy. They'll think he's an informant or something. They'd whack him right there. So he sits down and he's eating, and all of a sudden he starts to look at some of the guys, and he notices they have blood on their hands, and he's like, geez. And he heard the stories about the Houdini, so he knows all about, you know, what these guys were doing. So then he looks out the corner of his eye. The bathroom, the door is open a little bit. It's cracked open. And he notices there's a body hanging upside down. And he's like, geez. These Whoa. Guys are cutting up. They're right in the middle of it. So he throws his fork down in disgust. And Roy DeMeo looks at him and he's like, kid, what's the matter? You're not hungry? And he says to me, he says, Roy, he said, you know you guys got a body hanging up in your damn bathroom? And DeMeo looks back and then he says to me, he says, kid, don't worry about him. He ain't staying for dinner.
Oh, geez.
And that's you know, that's the thing that I think the viciousness that Hollywood doesn't show you about the mob, you know, like DeMeo and Coonan were just out of their mind crazy.
Okay.
So anyway, what happens is that cements the relationship between them, and what happens is the gangster I mentioned earlier, Ruby Stein, who was the loan shark, the Jewish loan shark. What happens is Coonan DeMeo plan to take over his action. So what they do is they borrow all his money. They borrow $50,000, $100,000, $200,000, right? Because they're not going to pay him back. Okay. So they do is they set him up and they invite him over to Jimmy Coonan's club on the west side. He comes in, they shoot him. And what they do is they do the Houdini. They get rid of him. The problem is that they made a mistake when they were doing this because they were still early in the learning stages of their Houdini process. And they didn't take the lungs out, and the body washed up on shore. So what happened is there was, all of a sudden there's investigation. So now the commission in New York is like, whoa, you know, Ruby Stein was our guy. What's going on here? They're hearing rumors that, you know, Coonan was involved, DeMeo was involved. So what they do is they set a meeting with Jimmy Coonan, and they invite him down to this Italian-American club in New mm-hmm. York. And all the bosses are there, all the bosses of the five families. Paul Castellano is the boss of the Gambino family, and he's there. And, of course, DeMeo's there. And DeMeo tells Coonan, you know, just don't say nothing, you know, it'll be okay. But Coonan's a little nervous, so what he does is he tells his guys, him and Mickey Featherstone were the two guys that were called in, they were going into the meeting. He told his guys, he said, if I'm not out in an hour, you guys are going to come in and just machine gun everybody, machine gun the whole place. So they were said, the Westies were set up across the street, and, you know, there was rumors they had grenades. Who knows what they had, because, like I said, these guys were nuts. And what happened was is Coonan went inside, and Castellano tells him, look, we want you guys to be with us. We want a working relationship, but you guys got to stop acting like cowboys. But what happened is they never stopped acting. You know, Castellano never had any control on Coonan. He never had any control on DeMeo. And that's what basically would cost him, you know, his life when John Gotti would later take him out. And John Gotti was at that meeting, too, and he developed a relationship with Coonan, which he would carry over to when he was boss.
Okay.
So, yeah. So, anyway, what happens is they're inside, and the meeting goes over a little bit, but the Westies that were across the street, they start drinking beers, they get a little drunk, they didn't realize the time, and it went over an hour, so, but they never came inside. Coonan realizes what time it is. He says, okay, let's get out of here, and they go out. So, nothing ever happened, but you know, it just goes to show you how crazy it could have been if you know, those guys went inside and start shooting it up. So anyway, what happens with the Westies is, you know, Coonan starts to become really close with Gotti, with DeMeo, and some of the other Westies, you know, they kind of, you know, didn't like that. So they're kind of developed a rift within the Westies. So what happens is Featherstone was planning on taking Coonan out. Coonan seen that, so Coonan set Featherstone up for a murder charge, and then Featherstone turns informant, and Coonan goes down, and that was basically the Westies. But between him and DeMeo, that was the craziest, you know, those two guys were the craziest that of all the gangsters I read about. You know, those two were the craziest. And then later on, I don't think we're going to get to it tonight, but I still want to go into the Gotti-Castellano hit, because that was really an important thing that went down in organized crime. You know, so that's pretty much New York. You guys have any questions?
No, I'm all set.
I think I'm good so far.
I think at this point, since you're going to stop with New York, I think it's probably a good time for us to take a quick break so our listeners can go grab an extra drink. Is that all right with you guys?
Yeah.
Yeah, that definitely. Sounds good.
All right, so everybody sit tight, and we will be right back.
All right, listeners, welcome back after that short little break. Just a little reminder here, we are with Sean Kane once again. Episode 56, Making of the Mob. So we just pretty much rounded the corner there of New York, and now navigation tells us we're going somewhere else, correct?
We're going to go to Boston. Yeah, we're going to go to Boston, which is a place I really know a lot about, and some stories I could tell you, some I can't, but it's going to be interesting.
All right.
Because when we go to Boston, we're going to, you know, there's one guy up there that everybody wants to talk about.
Whitey.
And that's, you know, Whitey Bulger.
Yep. Okay.
But, you know, there's so much other gangsters up there that just, you know, the reputation on the street that they had is just totally vicious, you know, besides Bulger. So, okay, so we talked about, you know, the commission in New York runs everything east. The outfit in Chicago runs everything west of the Mississippi. But the one thing is Boston kind of does their own thing. And they work within the framework of Cosa Nostra. I actually heard one law enforcement official describe Whitey Bulger as like this octopus, where the head of the octopus is in Salty, and the tentacles reach all across the U.S., down to Florida, out Midwest to Oklahoma. And that's a pretty good description. So they kind of do their own thing, and they work, but they work within the framework. Like, to give you an example, like, so Jimmy Burke in New York has this scheme going with, I don't know if you ever heard about the scandal with the Boston College basketball players.
Okay.
They were rigging games, and they had like three or four BC players on their payroll that were throwing games for them and stuff. And the one thing is, you know, Burke, when he goes, obviously he's going into Boston, so he's going into what is Winter Hill territory, which is the Irish mob. So at that time, Whitey wasn't the boss. So what he would do is he went to, the boss was a guy by the name of Howie Winter, and he would go to him and say, listen, you know, I'm doing this scheme and I'm going to cut you in. And then he'd also go to old man Patriarca, who ran one of the 26 Cosa Nostra families in Providence, Rhode Island. He ran it out of Federal Hill. So he was owning in his territory too. So he would go to him, and Jimmy Burke would say, you know, I'm going to cut you guys in because I'm doing this in your territory. And, you know, they would let him because they're making money off of it. So that's kind of the relationship they had. But the Winter Hill gang goes back, you know, generations. It's one of the oldest crime groups in the United States. And what happened is in the 60s, there was what would be called the Irish Gang Wars, and just a massive gang war broke out in New England. And Whitey Bulger, he gets a lot of credit for that, but he was actually in jail. He was in jail during most of the, especially the early part of the gang war, so he really had nothing to do with that. Okay. And it's interesting, when Bulger was in jail, I don't know if you guys know this, but he was part of the MK Ultra program, because what the CIA was doing was they would give LSD to inmates and see how their reaction was to it. And Bulger signed up for that program to get an early release. So, and he later on would claim that that would be one of the causes that made him so violent, because before that, because he was in jail for burglary, but he had no murder charges on, he had no, you know, violence in his background until he came out of prison. So basically what happens is the Winter Hill gang gets into it with the McLaughlin gang based in Charlestown. Now, Charlestown is famous for bank robberies. I don't know if you guys ever saw the movie The Town with, yep. with Ben Affleck.
Good movie.
Yeah, well... Yeah, well, that bar that movie was filmed in, Old Sully's, I've been in there many times, and that the guy that was based on was a guy by the name of Anthony Shea, who ran what they call the No Name Gang, and he hung out in that bar. But back in the 60s, the McLaughlins ran Charlestown, and they got into Winter Hill, and the Winter Hill was being run by a guy by the name of Buddy McLean, and he ends up getting killed. Now, the Patriarca family, which is based in Federal Hill, they're back in Winter Hill. So they get involved. I don't know how many people got killed, but what happens is Winter Hill comes out on top, and Winter Hill and Patriarca divide up New England. Bulger gets out of prison, and this is around like early 70s. And what happens is he's in jail, and he's planning his whole takeover when he gets out. Now, his brother would go on to be state senate president of Massachusetts and probably the most powerful politician at the state level in Massachusetts. I don't think there's any doubt about that. But when Bulger gets out of prison, he hooks up with this gang called the Killian, and they were running part of South Boston. They were the biggest gang in South Boston. But there's another gang in South Boston called the Mullen Gang, and they get into it with the Killians. And a shooting war breaks out. Now, Howie Winter is running Winter Hill Gang. Now, they have a loose affiliation with these two gangs at this point. There's nothing, you know, concrete. So he's kind of stays out of it. And what happens is Bulger's going after the Mullen Gang. And Bulger hooks up with a guy in the Killian Gang that actually had a reputation of being tougher than him, and that was a guy by the name of Billy O'Sullivan. And what happens is the Mullins take out, they kill Billy O'Sullivan. And then when that happens, all of a sudden everybody's like, wow, you know, he had the reputation as the toughest guy, and they took him out. And Bulger, this is where the street smarts of Whitey Bulger. He's on the losing side of the war, right? But he goes to Howie Winter, and he says to him, he says, we could end this war. He said, I'll take out the Killians. He says, and we'll bring everybody under your flag under Winter Hill. But he says, I want Southie. So you tell the Mullins, you know, they work for me. I run Southie, but I work for you. Now, Howie Winter knows the Mullins would be more loyal to him than Whitey Bulger. He knows Bulger would backstab him in a heartbeat. But he also knows he's a gangster. And he knows there's money to be made. And there's more money to be made with Bulger than there is with the Mullins. Mm-hmm. So they have this big meeting, and he tells the Mullins, this is what's going to happen. You guys are under my flag. Whitey's under my flag. He's going to take out the Killians, and he runs Southie. And they're like, geez, you know, we're winning this war, and all of a sudden now here we're working for this guy? You know, it's like crazy. So Whitey goes, and he takes out the one Killian brother. And then he tells the other ones, you know, you're finished. You guys are done. I'm taking over. So Bulger takes over Southie, and what happens is, and there was a lot of tough guys in Winter Hill. Like, I know everybody talks about Bulger, but there was like Stephen the Rifleman Flemmy he would end up being Bulger's right hand. He was actually Italian. He was a maniac. And there was another guy, Joe McDonald, who probably, I guarantee you never heard of him, but he had a reputation. Like, they would say that the cops would bring him in during the gang wars. They would bring him in and they would handcuff him to a chair, and they would beat him to a pulp and try to get him to talk, and he would never talk. And legend has it that, you know, the cops would get tired from punching him, and he would just say, you know, thanks for the workout, guys, and walk out like nothing, you know. And so he was a tough guy. He had a, you know, vicious reputation on the streets. So anyway, what happens is Bulger starts taking out and starts causing friction within the old Mullen gang. So he would, you know, have one associate. He would go to one associate at a Mullen gang saying, you know, that he was stealing money from this other one, and start to cause a lot of problems, and eventually, like, start taking them out one by one. And he would eliminate a lot of them. So the whole time while Bulger's coming up through the ranks at Winter Hill, he forms a relationship with Old Man Patriarca, who's running the Cosa Nostra family in Providence and Federal Hill. And they develop a really close relationship. A lot of people don't realize how close those two guys were. But I'll tell you a story about this is another viciousness of these guys. Okay. So Old Man Patriarca finds out that one of his guys, he thinks is an informant, but he can't prove it. So his there's two brothers, and they're both made guys in Patriarca. So what he does is he calls in the one brother that he knows he's not an informant, and he tells him, you know, I want you to beat the truth out of your brother. So they're in a basement somewhere, it was actually in a church in Providence, and they're in the basement, and Old Man Patriarca is there, and Whitey Bulger's there, and Patriarca is cooking them pork chops on a grill or on the stove, and the brother is beating the other brother to a pulp, you know, trying to get him to admit he's an informant. And here's Patriarca and Bulger, and they're cooking pork chops, and he's telling them, you know, Jimmy, how you like your pork chops? You want onions? And here, right in front of them, here's this two brothers, and one's beating the other one to death. I mean, that just shows you the viciousness. Yeah, and that just shows you the viciousness of the mob. But Bulger and Patriarca form a relationship, and what happens is Patriarca has his underboss is a guy by the name of Angiulo, Jerry Angiulo, and there was, I don't know how many brother Angiulo brothers, I think there was like six or seven of them, and what they did is they bought their way into the family. Like they were wealthy, and they kind of just bought their way in. They didn't pay their dues, they didn't come up through the ranks, so a lot of people inside the Cosa Nostra family didn't like them, and Bulger hated them. So they're working out of the north end of Boston, which is the Italian section. And Bulger wants them out of town. He wants nothing to do with them. And Patriarca realizes quickly that he made a mistake by letting these guys in, because he couldn't trust them. So he kind of stays out of the way and lets Bulger go at them. And a war develops between Bulger and Angiulo. And this is where a lot of people, you know, the movies kind of get it wrong. Like, there was never any friction between Bulger and Old Man Patriarca. It was always Bulger and Angiulo. So what happens is there's an FBI agent by the name of John Conley who grew up in Southie, and he was real close to Whitey's brother, the state Senate president, and he was real close to Jimmy Whitey Bulger too when they were younger. So he reaches out to Whitey, and he says, look it. He says, I want you to come in, be my informant, and help me take out Angiulo. And Whitey's like, look it, don't you know what I do to rats? I'm not a rat. And yeah, Conley says, well, you're not ratting. He says, we're forming an alliance. And he says, what do you think the Angiulos are going to do to you? He says, they're working with dirty cops, and they're going to use them to take you out. So he said, why don't you use us and use the FBI to help you take the Angiulos out? So that's the pitch he made to Bulger, and Bulger eventually goes for it. And the interesting thing is, when you look at all the files and everything that's been released, the information always seemed to be going from the FBI to Bulger. You know what I mean? Like, there was very little other outside of, like, gossip going from Bulger to the FBI.
Yeah,
so there was a relationship. There was a, you know, a partnership there. And what happens is Angiulo ends up going down. So they take out all the brothers. The FBI takes them all out. And in the meantime, right before that, there's a state police investigation. Now, the state police formed a Bulger task force. They were going after Bulger for a long time. And a lot of these guys in the state police, they were Irish. They didn't like Bulger. They didn't care that he was Irish. He was a criminal, you know. And they had a massive investigation into him. And what they were doing is the Winter Hill Gang was fixing horse races up and down the East Coast. They were in like 8 or 9 states. And the state police had them dead to rights. They had like 50 of the top guys in Winter Hill. So they were going down. And two of the guys were actually Whitey Bulger and Stephen the Rifleman Flemmy. So what happens is John Conley, the FBI guy, he goes to the U.S. attorney. I can't think of his name right now, but Jeremiah O'Sullivan. He was the U.S. attorney. And he was a friend of a very close political ally of William Bulger, Billy Bulger's brother, the state senate president. And he tells him, look, he said, Bulger and Flemmy are vital to us. He says, you gotta take their name off this indictment. So O'Sullivan goes along with it, and he takes Bulger and Flemmy's name off. And everybody else in Winter Hill, the top-level guys, the top 50 guys, they all go down. So now Bulger and Flemmy go into that vacancy, and they take over. And now Bulger's the boss of Winter Hill. And right after that, Angiulo goes down. So Bulger basically controls Boston. He's in complete control of Boston. And this is where the viciousness of Bulger. I mean, just to tell you some stories on how vicious he was. So basically he takes over, like he never wanted his guys to be directly involved in drugs. But what he would do is he would have them have all the drug dealers in New England pay rent. But one of the ways he would do this is there was a couple cycles in Boston that they looked like loose cannons, like they had no affiliation to anybody. And they would go and they were shaking down drug dealers and causing all kind of problems. And then Bulger would step in and say, look, you pay me and I could eliminate this problem for you. The thing is, all these what looked like independent cycles and stuff, they're all working for Bulger. So Bulger would be telling them, hey, go in, start shaking down this drug dealer, shake down this drug dealer. And then they would all come into his fold. And sooner or later, everybody in New England, all the drug dealers, they're all working for Bulger. So he completely takes over the rackets. And this is how he used the FBI. So there's another story where he finds out that there's an independent gang that's Colombians. And they have a warehouse in South Boston, and they're bringing in drugs. So Bulger's first instinct is, I'm going to take them out. But then he realizes, they're Colombians. They could be tied to Pablo Escobar. So there could be a lot of money to be made there. So he reaches out to Conley at the FBI, and he tells Conley, look, get on the horn, get the DEA, bust this warehouse. Then he turns around and he calls the Colombians. He reaches out to the Colombians. He says, guys, he says, I've just been tipped by somebody that's on my payroll that they're going to bust that warehouse. You got to get the hell out of there. So now the DEA jumps in. They they seize all the drugs. Conley writes up this big report that Bulger's this hero informant, this and that. He files it. The Colombians, they reach out to Bulger. They're happy. They're not going to jail. They think he saved their life. And he says, guys, you should have came to me first. This is how I do business. I would have set you up. Everything would have been protected. And this is how he worked the system. He worked the FBI. He worked the streets. You see what I'm saying?
Yep. Man, he did. It sounds like he had a system.
Oh, it's unbelievable. Yeah. Like the stuff. And the thing is, like I said, it's always the FBI is always the information's flowing from the FBI to Bulger. And it should have been flowing the other way. But I mean, just the viciousness of Whitey Bulger. I mean, it was just incredible. So anyway, he goes on to 25 years. He's running Boston, and we could go on with stories all night. But I just want to give you a couple more. So I want to say 1984. Bulger and Winter Hill, they're running guns to the Irish Republican Army in Northern Ireland. And the Winter Hill Gang has an association with the IRA going way back. So there's a ship called the Valhalla. And they were stockpiling weapons Do you guys familiar with the story or no?
No, but like, you know, Valhalla, it's like,
yeah, yeah, I know. Mm-hmm. So they're stockpiling weapons, and the just massive amounts of weapons, and a lot of them were actually, they were coming from U.S. Army bases. They were coming from Boston Police Department, that guns that were confiscated in raids and stuff. And it just shows you the reach of Whitey Bulger, you know what I mean? So they're stockpiling all these weapons. They're sending them over to the IRA. The problem is that there was a guy in the IRA that was an informant. I think his last name was Kelly. It's slipping my mind right now. But anyway, he rats out to the British and to the Irish authorities about this Valhalla. So they seize all the weapons, everything, and this is an embarrassment to, you know, the American government, because they're telling the British, you know, there's no, you know, Irish American support in the IRA, this and that, and here, you know, to confiscate all these weapons that say property of the U.S. Army, and, you know, Boston Police Department confiscated them and stuff. So the British is putting pressure, you know, we want to know who was behind this.
Okay.
So they bring in a guy, and his name's slipping my mind too. Can't think of his name, but he was McIntyre, John McIntyre. He was the captain of the ship, and they bring him in, and he cracks easily. So he starts naming names and stuff, and all of a sudden he names Whitey Bulger. Now, as soon as he does that, it gets back to Connelly at the FBI. So what do you think Connelly does? Turns right around and he tells Whitey Bulger, yep, knowing exactly what Whitey Bulger is going to do. So Bulger lures McIntyre down. They a couple of his guys, they torture him, try to find out what he said, and then they shoot him in the back of the head and they bury him. And this is where they found, like, later on they would find, like, they don't know how many people Bulger ordered killed or how many he killed, but they found, I think, like, two burial sites. I think there was, like, I don't know, 19 bodies or something they dug up that they know about. But, I mean, he just went on this vicious killing spree. And an interesting story that me and my brother, we were in one of the bars in Southie one time. I think it was Murphy's Law. I think you were in there, Jenna. You remember that?
Yeah, we went there.
Yeah. Well, we were in there. I forget what year this was. But we were in there, and we were drinking with some of the fellas in there. And one of the guys, his uncle was part of the task force that was going after Bulger. So this guy's got stories. So, of course, I'm, you know, talking to the guy, getting stories from him. And then he said one night he's going to invite his uncle out. So, you know, next time I went out to Boston, he invited his uncle out, and we were talking to him. And I asked him, I said, what always interests me about Bulger is he goes on his killing spree when he gets out in the early 70s to basically 1990. And then from 90 to 95, there's like no murders, you know what I mean? But Bulger's still the boss until finally he gets arrested and he goes on the lam. I says, what the heck happened in those 5 years that there's like no murders, no nothing? And he said to me, he said, Sean, he said, there was just nobody left. He said, everybody that was a threat to Whitey Bulger was either dead or jail. And that was
house.
It. He was in total control. He cleaned house. He absolutely,
yep,
cleaned
no targets.
House.
Like, it's kind of crazy to say that, because nothing. It's like, wow, I have nothing to, I have no work. You know? Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, he totally just controlled everything. And, you know, one more story I want to tell you before we get to how he actually got taken down, to show you the reach of Whitey Bulger. So there was a billionaire by the name of Roger Wheeler who owned a company called World Highlight. It was a like legal gaming company. They were in all different countries, and they had places in Florida, I think, and California. And Winter Hill was skimming from them. And what happened is Roger Wheeler found out about it, and he fired one of the head accountants, a guy by the name of John Callahan, who actually worked for Bulger. That's how they were skimming the money from it. So what happens is Bulger puts a hit on Roger Wheeler. Now, Roger Wheeler is in Oklahoma, and he has, this is how powerful this guy was, he has former FBI agents bodyguarding him. The problem is that some of those agents trace back to John Connally. So Bulger reaches out to Connally to them to get, you know, a whole map of the layout of his private golf club out there. And what Bulger does is he sends his two of his hitmen, Johnny Monterano and one of the guys I mentioned earlier, Joe McDonald, and they go out to Oklahoma and they shoot Roger Wheeler right in his golf club there, or the club there, his private club. And it's in the movie Black Mass. I'm sure you guys seen the movie Black Mass, right?
Yep.
Well, that's how it really happened. He was in there. He was going to his car, and then Johnny Monterano walks up to him and shoots him, and that's it. But then what happens is the Oklahoma FBI starts investigating, and the Tulsa Police Department start investigating, and they start quickly seeing that all signs lead back to Boston. So they're hot on the trail of John Callahan to see what he knows. In the meantime, Bulger knows that, and he knows Callahan's a loose end, so he sends Martorano to take out Callahan. So Callahan's down in Miami. He meets Martorano. Martorano shoots him, puts him in the back of the trunk of a car, and that's where they find him. Then another lead that the Oklahoma FBI had was a guy by the name of Brian Halloran, who was a Winter Hill guy who apparently... He started. He was kind of like an informant, and he started telling that Callahan came to him on behalf of Bulger to take out Roger Wheeler. So now the FBI or Oklahoma office, they start pursuing Callahan. So what do you think happens? It gets back to Connally. Connally goes to Bulger, and Bulger actually does that hit by himself. He shoots Callahan right in. Halloran, he shoots him right down, right in the Southeast Seaport, which is, it's known as the Southeast Seaport today, but he shot him right in the parking lot of a restaurant. And the thing is, there was an innocent guy that was in the car that his only crime was he was taking Halloran home. He knew him, he grew up by him, and he was taking him home, and he gets hit with the bullets when they start flying. So that just shows you how dangerous it is to be associated with any of these guys, you know what I mean?
Oh, definitely.
Yeah, for sure.
I mean, it's just – in one more story I want to tell you on Whitey. Do you guys know the association with Dana White? Do you guys ever hear this? You know what Dana White is? Ultimate Fighting?
Yeah.
Did you ever hear his association with Bulger?
No, this is news to me. I mean, I know who Dana White is to know him, but like
– So there was actually an ESPN. It wasn't one of those 30 for 30. It was one of those, I think it's called E60 or whatever. Yeah, they had a thing on this. But I saw a lot of interviews with Dana White and stuff, and I heard stories on the street too about it. But what happened was Dana White didn't – he wasn't a Boston guy. He wasn't born there, but he lived for a time period when he was younger. He lived in Southie. So what he does is he sets up these boxing gyms around the city and the fight clubs, and he's trying to get a business going. And he ends up getting a grant from the city and stuff. And what happens is all of a sudden he's got all these gyms going and stuff. And he's making decent money, but he starts to get on the radar of the Winter Hill Gang, who, you know, everybody's paying protection money to them. So a couple people reach out to Dana White. They say, you know, you're not paying anybody. You got to pay to operate here. And he didn't know who they were. He's just like, listen, guys, go. Don't bother me with this nonsense. So then a couple of days later, a guy by the name of Kevin Weeks shows up. And Kevin Weeks was one of Whitey's top guys. And everybody in Boston knows who Kevin Weeks was. So when he shows up, Dana White goes, oh, boy, this is Whitey Bulger. Because by this time, everybody knows, even if they don't see him, he's like the wizard in the Wizard of Oz. You know what I mean? Like, he's always there. Everybody knows who he is. So Kevin Weeks tells him, listen, you got to start paying to operate here. So now Dana White's starting to get nervous. So finally, he's not sure what to do. Finally, he gets a call from Kevin Weeks, and he says, you got till Friday to give us our money. If you don't, you know, this is going to be your last warning. So now, what do you think Dana White does? He hangs the phone up, picks the phone up, he calls Delta Airlines, and he gets a plane ticket to Vegas, and he gets the hell out of town. He leaves all his stuff in his apartment. This is how feared Bulger was on the streets. He leaves everything in his apartment, and he flies out to Vegas. And that's where he met up with, what's the two Italian brothers? I forget their names. Where they ended up, you know, taking over the UFC. I can't think of their names.
Oh, God, I don't know.
I don't follow you.
Yeah, so anyway, he ends up, he tells a story. He goes, you know, like, Bulger actually did me a favor because he ends up going on to massive amounts of wealth, you know, but it just shows you the fear that, you know, the Bulger had on the streets, where Dana White, his first instinct is, I'm getting on a plane, I'm getting the hell out of town, I'm leaving all my stuff. He left everything in his apartment.
But couldn't that have been the worst thing to do, is run?
Well, so here's the thing. So here's a story that I'm going to tell you that you're not going to hear on E60 that I heard on the streets. So what would happen later is once Dana White starts making big money, some of the guys, Bulger's guys, they reach out to Dana White. They go visit him there in his mansion out there. And this is the story I heard. They throw a duffel bag on the table and they tell him, listen, we're going back to Boston with Jimmy's money, which nobody called him Whitey. The cops called him Whitey. Everybody called him Jimmy. He said, we're going back to Boston with Jimmy's money in this bag or your head in the bag. You make the choice. And obviously they went back with the money.
So he did pay.
So that's, he never says that. He never admits that. He never, that's not, you
sure,
know, he never,
sure.
he
but
says
that's
that story.
But that's
not true.
The story.
But, I mean, you got to be realistic. Do you think that Whitey's really going to let him walk away?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, especially when he becomes, you know, what he became, you know, making all that money and just,
yeah,
you know,
sure.
He's making money hand over fist. I mean, Bulger's not going to let that go, you know? So what happens next is, you know, like I said, from 90 to 95, Bulger's still running things, but there's no murders because there's no threats. There's nobody is, you know, challenging Whitey Bulger. But what happens is there's this Polish prosecutor by the name of Fred Wycheck. He was in New York, and he prosecuted a lot of the mob cases there. And he goes to Boston, and he's looking into, you know, what's going on there. And there's, you know, like I said, Angiulos are gone. There's nothing going on there. But he says there's crime everywhere. There's organized crime everywhere. Like, who's running things? And quickly he realizes, you know, it's Whitey Bulger. So he goes after Bulger. And by this time, John Connolly had retired from the FBI. And Bulger's got a little bit complacent. So what Wycheck did is he went after some of Bulger's guys. And he went after some of the older guys who, they're already in poor health. So guys that were already dying of stomach cancer, this and that. And he says, you know, I'm going to go after your grandkids next and arrest them. Do you want to see them go to prison? So they kind of flipped. And then all of a sudden, it's like a house of cards. Everything starts falling apart, and Bulger goes on the lam. And again, he was tipped by Connolly. So Connolly tips him, indictments are coming down, Bulger takes off. So that was, what, 95, 96? And he was on the lam for, what, 17 years before they finally catch up to him. 2012, maybe? He gets caught in Malibu. He was hanging out with his girlfriend, and they were like an old retired couple hanging out in Malibu. And the interesting thing is the discipline that Bulger had. Like, from that, like, that period where he's on the lam, there's no evidence of any crimes that he committed, any violence, because he knows he doesn't want to bring attention to himself. You know what I mean? So he's acting like an old retiree guy.
Right.
Just hanging out in Malibu, you know? But some of the stories when he's on the lam, I'm going to give you two stories that are really interesting. Now, are they legend? What's that?
We're at time, though, so we're going to have to save those for another episode.
Okay.
I didn't realize we were over.
Yeah. We are pulling, the curtain's getting pulled here.
But we do get a to be continued.
Yeah, for sure.
We do get a part two coming. And I think right there, maybe that's actually a really good point where now we kind of just digest this. Now we kind of wait. And the waiting game is always a fun thing because what is going to happen next? You'll just have to know because you'll have to tune into part two.
And then, so for everybody that's going to stick with us for the next couple episodes, I'm going to give you a little sneak peek. The next episode that we're doing is we're going to review Shark Week activities. So if you guys want to get in on the action, Shark Week did start Sunday, July 11th. So check out some of those programs that we're going to be talking about. And then Matt's got some TV intros that we're going to discuss. Yep. Like TV
we'll
and
definitely
film
have
scores.
An episode dedicated to that.
And then I want everybody to put their thinking caps on, because I don't want to say it's going to be a controversial episode, but I want everyone to start thinking about sequels that are better than the original films. Because
yeah.
We're doing an episode on it, guys.
The sequels strike back.
The sequels. So, all right, guys, that wraps us up for this week's episode. And we will be back with Sean in a few weeks once we can hammer out the schedule. Thanks for joining us tonight, Sean. It's a blast, and we're always grateful to have you on.
All right, you're welcome. We'll continue this again.
Yes, and thanks, guys, and we'll be with you again next week. Have a good one.
Have a good one. Better made a little